Hi there, Up First listeners. Before we get to today's show, we'd like to ask you a favor. To make this podcast better, we'd like to know what you think.
So once you hear today's episode, you can visit npr.org/podcast survey for a short anonymous survey where you can tell us what you like, what can be improved, whatever you think we need to know about the show, but no profanities, please. That's npr.org/podcast survey. Thank you.
Haiti's trying to fill the political void left by the assassination of its president.
And the interim prime minister there tells me chaos in the streets does not mean no one's in charge.
I'm Scott Simon.
I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro, and this is Up First from NPR News. Haiti's Claude Joseph says Haiti is at a turning point.
What really matters today is not a dynamic of power struggle. We need to put ourselves together.
Some parts of the U.S. are losing ground in the fight against coronavirus, and officials say it's because there are just too few shots going into arms.
Plus, an economy in freefall in Lebanon, where even the middle class finds it hard to afford the basics, like food.
So please stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your weekend.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from TracFone Wireless, giving you control over your wireless plan. There's no contract, and unlimited talk and text smartphone plans start at just $20 a month, all on America's largest and most dependable networks. Learn more at TracFone.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor VMware. With app, cloud, security, and workspace solutions, VMware helps companies navigate change, meeting them where they are and getting them where they want to be faster. VMware, welcome change.
Even before the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, Haiti was dealing with problem upon problem: cholera, COVID, a devastatingly strong earthquake, and a painfully slow recovery, as well as armed street gangs and political instability.
Now, officials in Port-au-Prince are trying to decide who will lead Haiti out of the chaos and political vacuum, and I spoke with one of them.
And it's an exclusive interview. Nice work, Lulu, with the man who's been designated as Haiti's interim prime minister, right? His name is Claude Joseph. Give us some details.
Yes, Scott. We reached him yesterday afternoon, and I asked Claude Joseph who is in charge in Haiti right now. Here's part of what he told me.
I was the one who was acting prime minister when the president died. And actually, we were supposed to have someone who take charge right after the death, the tragic death of the president. And I was the one in charge. And I assumed this role. And until now, we do not have a state of chaos here. It's just because we were responsible enough. I'm talking about the ministers and myself. We were responsible enough to actually call on people for calm and working with different the national police and so on and so forth. But what really matters today is not a dynamic of power struggle. We need to put ourselves together.
So in other words, he's saying he continued in his role as prime minister because there was an immediate vacuum in leadership, but that he is actively working with the other two leaders who have a claim on the job, a man named as the next prime minister, Ariel Henry, and the current head of the Senate, a man named Joseph Lambert. He went on to say he's not interested in, quote, staying here where I am, but for the moment, he says, he's in charge.
And Lulu, did he have anything more to say about the investigation into the assassination of the president?
I mean, Scott, there had been some speculation about his role in what happened, and I asked him point blank about that. He did say, Scott, that he had nothing to do with it, and that the Haitian National Police are working with the FBI and Colombian intelligence, and that this is obviously a very sprawling investigation. There are many characters. There was a large plot, a large amount of money behind whoever organized it, but they are still trying to piece it together.
President Biden, of course, has said that he has no plans to send U.S. troops into Haiti. Does the interim prime minister want more U.S. assistance?
He does. He says the Haitian National Police at least need help with logistics, technical support, especially in fighting gangs which are, you know, roving wild all over Haiti. I pressed him on whether that means a return to peacekeeping troops.
Listen, I think we are at a crossroad in the country. Historic, I should say, turning point. So we need the international community, our friends, to understand that the situation is not what it should be. So some help they can deem necessary with the Haitian counterparts, I think that would be very important.
But I mean, is it peacekeeping troops? I mean, what do you imagine when you say help? What does that look like to you?
I think that any help that can help reinforce the national police, reinforce the security in Haiti. Correct.
So that's the word from Haiti. Yet another turning point.
Interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph did tell me more, and we'll have that Sunday morning on Weekend Edition. So tune in to listen to it there or find it afterwards at npr.org.
There are signs the pandemic is headed in the wrong direction as the highly contagious Delta variant spreads.
Yeah, cases are going up, so are hospitalizations and even deaths. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said in a briefing yesterday that the trend is clear.
This is becoming a pandemic of the unvaccinated. We are seeing outbreaks of cases in parts of the country that have low vaccination coverage because unvaccinated people are at risk.
NPR health policy correspondent Selena Simmons-Duffin joins us. Selena, thanks so much for being with us.
Morning, Scott.
So I gather numbers are going up, but not necessarily everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. So Walensky says it's a little bit of a mixed picture. Cases are rising in some places like California and New York that have pretty good vaccination rates. But she says by far the most spread is happening in places where not many people are vaccinated. In fact, she said 97% of people who get so sick with COVID-19 that they have to be hospitalized are unvaccinated. So now numbers are not expected to get nearly as bad as they were last winter, since that was before vaccines were widely available. But still, officials are concerned by these numbers and point out that sickness and death is avoidable. COVID-19 is now a vaccine-preventable disease, and people who've been holding out should get vaccinated.
Do scientists know why the Delta variant seems to be more transmissible than the original strain?
So actually, yes. I talked to virologist Angela Rasmussen about this. She's a research scientist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. And she pointed to a compelling preprint study out of China recently that showed people who were exposed to the Delta variant got sick fast.
And on top of that, when they started to test positive, their viral loads were 1,000 times higher than people who had been infected with a variant that had been circulating in 2020.
That suggests people infected with Delta are shedding way more virus, which could explain why it's so contagious. Rasmussen says the good news is that it still transmits in the same way as the original strain. So all of those mitigation tools like masking and hand washing and social distancing, all of those still work to block Delta. And the vaccines are still highly effective against this variant.
Does this mean that vaccinated people don't need to worry right now? CDC guidelines still say that vaccinated people, for the most part, don't need to wear masks. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. But I would say CDC is a bit out of step with a growing chorus of health experts on this front who say it does make sense to wear masks indoors if you're going out in public. This is Helen Chu. She's a professor of medicine at the University of Washington.
I would. So I haven't stopped masking indoors. I live with unvaccinated children. I do not want to put them in a situation where I may transmit to them.
So even though the chances of getting very sick and dying from COVID-19 are very low for vaccinated people, the risk is not zero, and people can still get infected, especially if there's a lot of virus circulating in their community.
Selena, does it seem like the CDC might take another look at those masking guidelines right now?
Right now, it does not seem so. CDC is standing firm. When asked about it at the briefing yesterday, Walensky only said that in places that are hotspots, where there's low vaccination rates, it may make sense for local officials to consider masking requirements until the vaccine campaign can catch up. But I should say that one large county, LA County, made that call this very week. An indoor mask mandate for everyone, including vaccinated people, goes into effect at midnight tonight. So we'll have to see if other places follow suit.
NPR health policy correspondent Selena Simmons-Duffin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The World Bank says the economic crisis in Lebanon is one of the worst that the world has seen in over a century. And this is happening in a country with famous tourist sites that's had a thriving middle class and legendary nightlife. It means you might see people breaking down in the grocery store with sticker shock. at common items like milk or meat as inflation rises.
Or spend hours searching nearly empty pharmacies for medicines that they need to survive. NPR's Ruth Sherlock is in Beirut and joins us now. Ruth, hello.
Hi, Lulu.
I mean, let's start with the people. Tell us what they've been saying to you.
You know, it's really terrible. Yesterday, we went to this Armenian Christian neighborhood that used to be thriving, and we met Hazmet Abatyan there. She was a home care worker, but now has no regular income. And she tells us anything she does earn doesn't go far because inflation now means everything is so expensive. She's saying she can't even afford to pay for a generator to get electricity when state power is out. And this is really one of the basics in Lebanon because state power now only works for a couple of hours a day sometimes. And it is a swelteringly hot summer here. She also says she hasn't made her rent payments in months and now she'll be evicted by the end of July if she can't pay. And, you know, this is actually really typical of the stories I've been hearing. We've also met an out-of-work chef who now collects trash for a living, and a teacher who can't make ends meet on their salary. And that's not surprising because, just to give you one example, baby milk now costs about a quarter of what they would earn here in a month.
A month?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, so even if people have money, are there things they can buy?
Well, there are shortages of many of the basics. So you see fuel lines now that are miles long and people are sitting in their cars and then getting out and pushing them by hand to get it to move forward in those lines because they don't have enough fuel. We've already talked about the power cuts. But most seriously, though, is the impact on the healthcare system. Public hospitals are shutting down because they don't have money to operate. And shelves in pharmacies are sparsely stocked. I've seen people in despair because they've gone from pharmacy to try to find important, sometimes life-saving medication, and they can't.
All right, take us now to the economic side of this. Why is this all happening?
Well, the thing is, this is sadly, in many ways, a preventable crisis of Lebanon's own making. The people in the government and the banking sector here either mismanaged, squandered, or stole cash reserves, and now the state is out of money. Lebanese people are understandably furious. I spoke about this with Yasmin Masri. She became an instant celebrity here recently when a video went viral showing her shouting, "Shame on you," at a politician while he was eating in a restaurant, and his bodyguards beat her up. She tells me the crisis is, in a way, uniting people.
Because you know what actually unites people? When everybody gets poor, when everybody in the same country cannot go to the bank, cannot have medicine, cannot have water running, cannot have electricity, then everybody's looking at the same, you know, disaster, and this is when you wake up.
Lebanon is a very divided country, and people used to support politicians that represent their religious sect. But now, increasingly, people I speak to say, you know, all politicians are the same. They're all part of the same corrupt political class.
So is there any help on the way from the rest of the world?
That's what Lebanese politicians want, but the international community has seen financial help here squandered in the past through incompetence and corruption. They want major reforms, but at the moment, those politicians don't seem able or willing to implement these.
That's NPR's Ruth Sherlock in Beirut. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's Up First for Saturday, July 17, 2021. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up First is back Monday with news to start your week.
You can follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter.
And don't forget about that chance to tell us what you think of Up First. You can help make us better by answering a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcastsurvey. And thank you so much for helping us out.
And for more from Haiti and Cuba and the economy here at home, as well as some new music by Chase Bryant and Keegan-Michael Key on his new series, you can tune into us on the radio.
Weekend Edition is on Saturday and Sunday mornings. You can find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
Investigations into police use of force and misconduct were secret in California until now. We've sifted through hours of interrogation tape to find out who does the system of police accountability really serve and who does it protect. Listen now to every episode of the new podcast, On Our Watch, from NPR and KQED.